I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, serious topics, in-depth discussion, and today we're looking at the continuation of our series on fascism with a specific understanding of the Federal Reserve, the banking system, and exposing the financial characters who are behind the scenes. We'll have special commentaries from Professor Peter Phillips and Bradley Osborne of Global Research. Also, Facts About the Federal Reserve, Everyone Should Know by Michael Snyder. We'll look at the global credit excess that is worse than before the 2008 crash by Washington Blog, and how big banks are manipulating gold and silver markets and are grossly understating their real value. The World Bank is a money laundering enterprise, and everyone on the inside knows that from the real agenda. And for Max Keiser, we're on a gold standard now, even though it's not recognized. And finally, time permitting, from Ellen Brown, a financial Armageddon, looting machine, looming mass destruction from derivatives. Also, we'll be having two video clips that you can watch that are of interest. One we'll discuss about money itself, as most people are simply not fully up to date on how it all evolved. And the second part is, behind almost every war, there are banks who profit from the war. And there's a whole wonderful history of how this has evolved. So at least by the end of this program, you will have an understanding of how the most powerful financial interest in the world have conspired with leading political leaders to gain control and game our systems. They control the media as well. Now, this is only one part. In the next part, I'll be going into greater depth on this because we have so much information to cover, it is not possible in just one program. But first, we want to expose the financial core of the transnational capitalist class. And in this discussion, I'm going to go into great depth about how few people and their organizations are in control of everything. This is not a conspiratorial theory. This is reality. All of the information I'm about to share is a matter of public record. And we thank Peter Phillips and Bradley Osborne for their scholarship in this effort. But first, a brief history of research on the American power elite. And if you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you know that the puppets in power are not the real purveyors of that power. It's who's behind them. You've heard me mention many times that the top people in our society are selected before they're elected. A long tradition of sociological research documents the existence of a dominant ruling class in the United States, whose members set policy and determine national political priorities. The American ruling class is complex and competitive, and perpetuates itself through interacting families of high social standing with, well, similar lifestyles, corporate affiliations, and memberships in elite social clubs and private schools. You and I are excluded. The American ruling class has long been determined to be mostly self-perpetuating, maintaining its influence through policymaking institutions like, well, the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Business Roundtable, the Conference Board, the American Enterprise Institute for Public Research Policy, the Council on Foreign Relations, and other business-centered policy groups. These associations have long dominated policy decisions within the U.S. government. In his 1956 book, The Power Elite, C. Wright Mills documented how World War II solidified a trinity of power in the United States that comprised corporate, military, and government elites in a centralized power structure motivated by class interest and working in unison through higher circles of contact and agreement. Mills described how the power elite were those who decided whatever is decided of major consequence. These higher decision makers tended to be more concerned with interorganizational relationships and the functionings of the economy as a whole, rather than with advancing their particular corporate interest. The higher circle policy elites are a segment of the American upper class and are the principal decision makers in society. Now, there are only two types of people in power, policymakers and opinion leaders. The policymakers are those who decide what is in the best interest of what they believe in, and then the policymakers are those that we generally see or hear or read. And these are people who never set policy, but they certainly are there to defend it and promote it. Now, although these elites display some sense of we-ness, they also tend to have continuing disagreements on specific policies and necessary actions in various socio-political circumstances. These disagreements can block aggressive reactionary responses to social movements and civil unrest, as in the case of the labor movement in the 1930s and the civil rights movement in the 1960s. During these two periods, the more liberal elements within the higher circle policy elites tended to dominate the decision-making process and supported passing the National Labor Relations and Social Security Acts in 1935, as well as the Civil Rights and Economic Opportunities Acts in 1964. Now, these pieces of national legislation were seen as concessions to the ongoing social movements and civil unrest, and were implemented instead of instituting more repressive policies. However, during periods of threats from external enemies, as in World War I and II, more conservative reactionary elements of the higher circle policy elites successfully pushed their agendas. During and after World War I, the United States instituted repressive responses to social movements, for example, through the Palmer Raids and the passage of the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, and after World War II, the elites allowed and encouraged the McCarthy-era attacks on liberals and radicals, and in 1947, passage of the National Security Act and the Anti-Labor Taft-Hartley Act. In the past 25 years, and especially since the events of 9/11, these elites in the United States have been united in support of an American empire of military power that maintains a repressive war against resisting groups. Now, they'll dub you, if you resist them, as terrorist anywhere in the world. This war on terror is much more about protecting transnational globalization, the free flow of financial capital, dollar, power, and access to oil, than it is repressing terrorism. Increasingly, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is nothing more than the attack dog and a partner with U.S. global dominance interest. Capitalist power elites exist around the world. The globalization of trade and capital brings the world's elites into increasingly interconnected relationships, to the point that sociologists have begun to theorize the development of a transnational capitalist class. In one of the path-breaking works in the field, The Transnational Capitalist Class, Leslie Sklar argued that globalization elevated transnational corporations to more influential international roles, with the result that national state interests became less significant than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations was a transnational capitalist class, whose loyalties and interest, while still rooted in their corporations, was increasingly international in scope. And Sklar wrote, quote, "The transnational capitalist class can be analytically divided into four main fractions: owners and controllers of the transnational class and their local affiliates, globalizing bureaucrats and politicians, globalizing professionals, and consumerist elites," meaning the merchants and the media. It is also important to note, of course, that the transcapitalist class, and each of its fractions are not always entirely united on every issue. Nevertheless, together, leading personnel in these groups constitute a global power elite, dominant class, or inner circle, in the sense that these terms have been used to characterize the dominant class structures of specific countries, end quote. William Robinson followed in 2004 with his book, The Theory of Global Capitalism, Production, Class, and the State of a Transnational World. Robinson claimed that 500 years of capitalism had led to a global shift in which all human activity is transformed into capital. In this view, the world had become a single market, which privatized social relationships. He saw the trans-capitalist class as increasingly sharing similar lifestyles and patterns of higher education and consumption. The global circulation of capital is at the core of an international bourgeois who operate in the clusters around the world. These clusters of elites form strategic transnational allegiances through mergers and acquisitions with the goal of increasing concentration of wealth and capital. The process creates a polyarchy of elites. The concentration of wealth and power at this level tends to overaccumulate, leading to speculative investment and wars. The trans-capitalist class makes efforts to correct and protect its interests through global organizations. They own, they control completely 100% of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the G20, the World Social Forum, Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, the Bank of International Settlements, and other transnational associations. Robinson's claim within this system that the nation-states become little more than population containment zones, and their real power lies with the decision-makers who control global capital. Now, deeper inside the transnational capitalist class is what David Rothkopf calls the superclass. In his 2008 book, Superclass, The Global Power Elite in the World They Are Making, Rothkopf argued that the superclass is only about 6,000 to 7,000 people. Well, let me put that in perspective. That's 0.0001% of the world's population. They are the Davos-attending, Gulfstream private jet-flying, money-encrusted, mega-corporation interlocked, policy-building elites of the world, people at the absolute peak of global power and the pyramid. They are 94% male, predominantly white, and mostly from North America and Europe. Rothkopf reported that these are the people setting the agendas at the G8 and G20, NATO and World Bank and World Trade Organization meetings. They are from the highest levels of finance capital, transnational corporations, the government, and the military, the academic, non-governmental organizations, spiritual leaders, and other shadow elites. In fact, they are always the head of everything that happens in the world where profit is made and power is maintained. Rothkopf's definition of the superclass emphasizes their influence and power. Although there are over 1,500 billionaires in the world, not all are necessarily part of the superclass in terms of influencing global policies. Yet these 1,500 billionaires possess two times as much wealth as the 2.5 billion least wealthy people, and they are fully aware of this vast inequalities. The billionaires inside of the transcorporate class are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power. Yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. As a result of these class insecurities, the trans corporate class works to protect its structure of concentrated wealth. Protection of capital is the prime reason that NATO continues now, accounts for 85% of the world's defense spending, with the U.S. spending more on military than the rest of the world combined. Fears of rebellions motivated by inequality and other forms of unrest motivate NATO's global agenda in the war on terror as well as the United States Defense Department. It is not the terrorist in the Sudan. It is not a Taliban fighter in the mountains near Kabul. Rather, it is the average American finally waking up one day and realizing that their government is owned completely, the politicians totally, the media 100% by these policymakers. And they have been played, they've been used, they've been abused, and all the while they have been indoctrinated into believing that someone was out looking after their best interest. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is no governmental agency, there is no bank in the major corporate class that's primary interest is serving the public interest. NATO is quickly emerging as the police force for the transnational capitalist class. As the transcorporate class more fully emerged in the 1980s, coinciding with the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO became broader in its operations. NATO first ventured into the Balkans, where it remains, and then into Afghanistan. NATO started a training mission in Iraq in 2005 and has recently conducted operations in Libya, and as of July 2013, is considering military action in Syria. Superclass use of NATO for its global security is part of an expanding strategy for U.S. military domination around the world, whereby the U.S. NATO military industrial media empire operates in service to the transcorporate class for the protection of international capital everywhere in the world. The most recent work on the transcapitalist class is William K. Carroll's The Making of a Transnational Capitalist Class in 2010. Carroll's work focused on the consolidation of the transnational corporate policy networks between 1996 and 2006. He used a database of the boards of directors of the global 500 largest corporations showing the concentrated interconnectivity of key corporations and a decreasing number of people involved. According to this analysis, the average size of the corporate boards has dropped from 20 to 14 members in the 10 years of this study. Furthermore, financial organizations are increasingly the center of these networks. Carroll argued that the transcorporate class at the centers of these networks benefit from extensive ties to each other, thus providing both the structural capacity and class consciousness necessary to effectively create political solidarity. After all, think of it this way. Virtually all the major banks on Wall Street, though they are competitors at one level, they are all great white sharks looking for someone's nosebleed. A 2011 University of Zurich study completed by Stefanini Vitali and James Gladerfelder and also others have found that the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology reported that a small group of companies, mainly banks, wield huge power over the global economy. Applying mathematical models, usually used to model natural systems, to the transnational corporations in the world, the study found 147 companies, I repeat, 147 companies control 40% of the entire world's wealth. Although sociological theorists conduct studies of the world's power elite, these researchers rarely identify specific members of the transnational capitalist class, preferring instead to build theory for other academics to read and discuss while avoiding the particulars of who is actually involved. The world's corporate media pay absolutely no attention to academic concepts like transnational capitalist class. Thus, the NexusLexis search of news coverage completed on June 3, 2013, using the term transnational capital class, turned up only three news stories in the past decade, two from foreign media, and the third is merely a letter to the editor by Leslie Sklar. Hence, zero, not a single piece of coverage from any of the mainstream media in the United States in any form. So the concept of a transnational capitalist class is absent from corporate news media, which also does not address who constitutes this most elite powerful group. We think that the world needs to know who comprises the transcapitalist class, the super elite, and thus who makes the financial decisions regarding global capital, war, who decided we should go to Iraq, Afghanistan. These are all the same people, one and the same. Let me tell you now, the world's top 35 asset management firms in terms of trillions of dollars. At the top, BlackRock, $3.5 trillion. UBS Switzerland, $2.2 trillion. Allianz Germany, $2.2 trillion. Vanguard USA, $2 trillion. State Steel Global Advisors, $1.9 trillion. PIMCO, which means Pacific Investment Management Company in the U.S., $1.8 trillion. Fidelity Investments, USA, $1.5 trillion. AXA Group, France, $1.3 trillion. J.P. Morgan Asset Management, USA, $1.3 trillion. Credit Suisse, Switzerland, $1.2 trillion. Bank of New York Mellon Asset Management 1.2 trillion, HSBC UK 1.2, Dutch Bank of Germany 1.2, Bank of New York, Paribas France 1.1, Capital Research Management of US 1 trillion, Prudential Financial 960 billion, Amundi France 880 billion, Goldman Sachs 836 billion, Wellington Management 719 billion, and Natixis Global Asset Management France 710 billion, Franklin Resources, Franklin Templeton Investments 707 billion, Northern Trust USA 704 billion, Bank of America US 682 billion, Invesco US 646 billion, Lake Mason US 631 billion, Nippon Life Insurance Company Japan 600 billion, Legal and General Investment Management UK 598 billion, and Generali Group Italy 581 billion, Prudential UK 570 billion, T. Rowe Price US 541 billion, Wells Fargo US 534 billion, and Manulife Financial Canada 513 billion, Sun Life Financial Capital 496 billion, and TIAFF US 481 billion. Now, seven of the top 10 asset management firms were in the top 10 of the most centralized firms from the Swiss study. So, let's take a look at the identity of the people on the boards of directors, the top 10 management asset firms, and the top 10 most centralized corporations. These then represent the most powerful people in the world. And these people have enormous influence. With overlaps, there's a total of 13 firms in the study: Barclays, BlackRock, Capital Group Companies, FMR Corporation, Fidelity Worldwide Investments, AXA Group, State Street Corporation, JP Morgan Chase, Legal and General Group, Vanguard Group, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Credit Suisse, Alliance, owners of PIMCO and PIMCO Pacific Investment, and the boards of directors of these firms, totaling 161 individuals, represent the financial core. This is the vortex of the world's transnational capitalist class. Collectively, these individuals I just mentioned manage $23.91 trillion in funds and operate nearly every country of the world. And the $23.9 trillion does not include the equity balances, which number into the billions of dollars that each of these firms holds in company assets. Nor does it include the $18.8 trillion controlled by the next 25 most valuable asset companies. The bank Barclays, the most wealth-centered centralized corporation in the world, sold its global asset management division to BlackRock in 2009. The result is that BlackRock is now the single largest asset management firm, though Barclays remains one of the most wealth-centralized firms with company assets of $2 trillion. Now, the 161 directors of the 13 mostly centralized largest asset management firms represents the central core of international capital. As such, these 161 people share a common goal of maximum return on investments for their clients and will seek to achieve returns sometimes by any means necessary, legal or not. Authorities have deemed the largest banks too big to fail and too big to jail. So what I'm saying is this: the individuals, the banks they control, the asset funds they oversee, means they virtually live by a law to themselves. They are held not accountable for anything. None of them will ever see the inside of a jail. Their reputations will never be besmirched, and the media cannot go after them, nor any politician, nor any government, without severe repercussions. They literally have the power to dominate every discussion. They can always say, "Go after one of us, we're all against you." No politician, no prosecutor, no attorney general will ever challenge them. They're simply that fearful. Therefore, they control the source of blackmail. Mess with us, and we will mess with you. The American government has refused to prosecute any officials from the multitude of banks who have laundered billions of dollars in illegal drug cartels, powerful banking corporations such as JP Morgan Chase, a criminal organization, have continually refused to comply with American anti-money laundering laws. This refusal to prosecute is so often held as an honorable move that serves to protect all individuals from devastation. Thus, Assistant Attorney General Lanny Brewer explained the refusal to prosecute the bank HSBC. Had the U.S. authorities decided to press criminal charges, HSBC would almost certainly, quote, lost its banking license in the U.S. The future of the institution would have been under threat, and the entire banking system would have been destabilized, end quote. I consider that moronic. In point of fact, I believe that if every major bank were allowed to go through structured bankruptcy, eliminate all derivatives, and allow no longer to deal with anything outside of the strict compliance of the Glass-Steagall Act, we would be much more stable, and also to have forgiveness on all loans, interest on all loans to African countries, and those that they have exploited through the structural adjustment of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Not only are these powerful corporations considered too big to fail, they appear to come too big to tell apart. Traditionally, banks have been understood as separate entities, competing against one another in order to entice consumers to deposit funds and invest. And such competition theoretically forces banks to compete to offer the best rates. However, in reality, these banks found that competing against one another was less profitable than working together. In realizing that their interests lie side by side, the financial core, the trans-corporate class, have been highly motivated to join forces, legally or not, to manipulate laws, policies, and governments to their advantage. Remember, they can buy anyone in government because everyone, with few exceptions, are for sale. The ramifications, the lack of competition in the banking industry are devastating. Consider, for example, price-fixing scandals as LIBOR, or ISDA fix. J.P. Morgan Chase, UBS, and Barclays, among the 13, were implicated in the LIBOR scandal, falsely looking at the data and then manipulating to be used to create benchmark rates. Based on fake data, these rates affected the prices of everything from your home and auto loan to student loans and credit cards to mortgages and commercial loans, and even the price of currencies themselves. The Financial Service Authority in the United Kingdom fined Barclays a mere $450 million and several other banks. The ISDA fix scandal looks a lot like the LIBOR case. The same superpower banks are currently under investigation to determine whether or not they manipulated the ISDA fix, a benchmark number used to calculate the prices of global interest rate swaps. And because cities and sovereign governments use interest rate swaps to help manage their debts, manipulation of those rates has far-reaching impacts, particularly for the poor and working classes, as economic safety nets are subject to austerity measures, budget cuts. Not only were rates illegally fixed and data falsified constantly, but the offending banks also used individual consumer investments to engage in criminal activity. The Vanguard Group was accused of investing its clients' money into illegal offshore gambling sites, prompting a class-action lawsuit under the Racketeering Influence and Corruption Act, the RICO. And Vanguard did not deny such wrongdoing, but a judge determined that when the plaintiff's Vanguard's clients were harmed, they lost their money due to the government's crackdown on such illegal gambling rather than due to the Vanguard's investing in such sites. However, it is clear that if Vanguard had not invested client money in illegal ventures, there would have been no negative repercussions from such a government crackdown. As journalist Matt Taibbi declared, everything is rigged. Vanguard Group and BlackRock are major investors in Sturm, Ruger, and Company, a leading firearms manufacturer. Though there is nothing illegal about such investments, we can wonder about the consequences of such a pairing. With the expansion of private police and military companies, the power elites seemingly are investing in the violent means with which to maintain and further their power. And also, with money comes power, influence, and propaganda. BlackRock and numerous other banks and Wall Street institutions are financially backing groups like Parent Revolution and Students First, whose agendas are to privatize and subsequently corporatize the public school system. The transnational capitalist class is laying the foundation for the privatization of everything in the world. If public democratic institutions, including schools, post offices, universities, the military, even churches, become privately owned entities, then corporate interests will truly dominate. Then we become neo-feudal societies where the reign of kings is replaced by private corporate ownership and the people will serve only as peasants. We do not claim that any single person identified as one of the 161 individuals at the financial core of the transcorporate class has done anything illegal. We only point out that the institutional structural arrangements with the money management systems of global capital relentlessly seek ways to achieve maximum return on investment, that the conditions for manipulations, legal or not, always hold true. Remember, in America, we never go after the person, only the institutions that they run. Hence, the institution pays a fine, walks away, and everything is fine. In conclusion, 136 of the 161 core members are male, 88% are whites of European descent, 52% hold graduate degrees, and almost all have attended the private schools, mainly Harvard, Oxford, Stanford, Cambridge, University of Chicago, University of Cologne, Columbia, Cornell, and the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and University of California, Berkeley. Members of the financial core take active parts in global policy groups and government. 5 of the 13 corporations have directors or advisors of former employees of the International Monetary Fund. 6 of the 13 firms have directors who have been worked or served as advisors of the World Bank. 5 of the 13 firms hold corporate membership in the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States, and 7 of the firms sent 19 directors to attend the World Economic Forum this year. 7 of the directors have served or currently serve as Federal Reserve Board, and so it goes. They're all part of the Business Roundtable, and they serve as financial ministers for the European Union. No matter where you go, they control the game. Now, let's take a look at a short piece that gives you a better understanding of how corrupt the banking system is.
Banking, the greatest scam on earth. Thomas Jefferson said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." Jefferson's warning is already here. 40 million Americans are living on food stamps. Millions more are now homeless, living in tents, all because of one institution, the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve is a group of private bankers who have stolen the money creation process from the American people. Most people still believe the Fed is an agency of the government working in our best interests. It is not. There is no greater form of evil in the world today, so let's explore the banking scam. None of us have ever been taught anything about money. The reason is to prevent us from learning the truth that money is a trick and money is a trap. When solving any crime, there's a universal truth: follow the money. But with the banking scam, follow it backwards. Where does money come from? The world's money supply is always growing. Where does all the new money keep coming from? Money comes from privately controlled global banks like the Federal Reserve System. They create money every day, which increases the world's money supply. Because all banks are either owned or controlled by private bankers, the real question is, how do private bankers create new money? And the answer is, they create it out of thin air. Bankers create money out of nothing. They make it up. It is a fiction. Wow. Godlike power to create something of value out of nothing. A stroke of a keyboard and money is created. In fact, only 3% of the world's money is even in the form of bills and coins, which means 97% of all money in the world is just numbers typed on a computer screen. This is part one of the banking scam. Money is created out of nothing. The second part of the scam is this phony money is issued as debt. What is debt exactly? Well, when you consider we work our whole lives to pay it off, you could say debt is slavery. But whose debt is this phony money? It's our debt, all of it. It's our debt when we use credit cards, we get student loans, borrow money for mortgages, all bank borrowing. And it's our debt again when the government borrows, which is each and every day. In today's world, money is debt, and debt is money, and don't forget the interest charges. Money equals debt, and debt equals slavery. Therefore, money equals slavery. Our monetary system is a carefully concealed system of slavery. Why? Because our government can create the same money for free with no interest charges, just like they used to as the Founding Fathers designed it inside the United States Constitution for our protection against private bankers. The third part of the banking scam is very evil. When bankers create money from nothing and issue it as debt, they only create the principal portion of the debt. They do not create the money for the future interest payments. There is not enough money in existence for all of us to make our interest payments. In fact, our money creation system is even mathematically impossible. Money issued by the banks, principal debt, does not equal the money demanded back to the banks, principal plus interest. We are forced to play a game of musical chairs to see who can make their debt repayments. This guarantees a world of bankruptcy, competition, and scarcity of money. For example, we go to the bank to borrow money for a house, let's say $100,000. The moment we sign the loan document, the bank creates the money out of thin air. A $100,000 debit gets registered for us and a $100,000 secured credit for them. Then one of two things happens. Either we give the bank 30 years of labor making house payments totaling $300,000 for the original $100,000 we borrowed, or the bank takes our house. The bankers get either our labor for life or our house, and often they get both, all from money created out of thin air and issued as debt, for money made out of nothing. This is why all the bankers end up with all the assets. The fourth part of the banking scam is inflation. People think inflation is prices and costs increase. A better answer might be the value of our money always goes down. Inflation is created every time the central banks print money, which is every day. Where does all this new money get its value? The answer is, it steals its value from the existing money supply, where our savings are. Our savings are disappearing because of the new money they're printing. If money creation was in balance with goods and services, there would be no inflation. Prices would stay the same. But the reality is banks always print money, driving prices ever higher, which steals the value of our savings, making them disappear. Since the private bankers created the private Federal Reserve in 1913, the United States dollar has lost 97 cents in purchasing power. An item in 1913 that costs $100 in 2011 costs $2,230, a price increase of 2,130%. This is the banking scam. Four parts. Private bankers create money out of nothing and charge interest on it. There is no money created for the future interest payments, and inflation steals our savings every day. In order for the banking scam to be pulled over our eyes, the bankers need help from the likes of paid-for politicians and appointed civil servants, military-industrial complex, mainstream media, multinational corporations, and the bankers' good buddies. For example, what do our banker-controlled television networks say about criminal bankers? Oh, bankers are our saviors. Chairman is man of the year. He saved the world. Bankers really do deserve their bonuses. They're so smart. And what do our banker-owned G20 politicians say we need to do? That we must save our banking system, and now we need austerity measures, like increasing existing taxes and bringing in new taxes, cutting our social programs, including education and health care, stealing from our pension plans while increasing the retirement age, keeping us working for more years at lower wages while placing our children and grandchildren in debt and servitude for their future lives. We are being lied to that we must go deeper in debt for bailouts, stimulus packages, quantitative easing, saving the too-big-to-fail banks, credit easing, currency interventions, all names that mean the same thing, more debt to us. Is it not strange that the solution to too much debt is always more debt to us? And where is all this money going? It's going to the banks and to the bankers. They are stealing our money right now. one-tenth of 1% of the world's population owns two-thirds of the world's wealth. This means that 99.99% of the world's population own less than a third of the wealth, a decreasing amount, because these guys are stealing it. We desperately need to wake up to the banking scam. It is time for change. To retake control of our money system, we must stop supporting the banking scam. Lincoln said the government should create all the currency and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of government and the buying power of consumers. Money will cease to be master and will then become servant of humanity. And Jefferson said the issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. It's a pyramid scheme. And we, the people, are the bottom layers of the banking pyramid. Without our support, the banking scam collapses. We have to do it ourselves. Wake up, get active, wake others, remove our money from the bank. Buy gold and silver coins, get out of debt, rip up your credit cards. These actions will bring down the banking scam. Only vote for politicians who support debt-free money, or run for office yourself, and turn off mainstream media to search for the truth while you still can, and support every effort to end the Federal Reserve System and all the privately owned central banks. Let's bring these criminals to justice to get our money and our countries back before it's too late.
Mike Snyder also has something from Economic Collapse blog entitled Facts About the Federal Reserve Everyone Should Know. Why? Because we're approaching the 100-year anniversary of the creation of the Federal Reserve. I believe it's imperative that we get the American people to understand that the Fed is at the very heart of our economic problems. It is completely a criminal organization. It is a system of money that was created by the bankers and that operates for the benefit of the bankers. The American people like to think that we have a democratic system, but there is nothing democratic about the Federal Reserve. It's unelected, unaccountable. Its central planners from private central banks run our financial system and manage our economy. There's a reason why financial markets respond with a yawn when Barack Obama says something about the economy. But they swing wildly when Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke opens his mouth. The Federal Reserve has far more power over the U.S. economy than anyone else does on the planet. The Fed is the biggest Ponzi scheme in the history of the world. And if the American people truly understand, then they will stop supporting it. Here are some facts you should know about the Federal Reserve. The greatest period of economic growth in U.S. history was when there was no central bank, no Federal Reserve. The U.S. never had a persistent ongoing problem with inflation until the Federal Reserve was created. In the century before the Federal Reserve was created, the average annual rate of inflation was just 0.5%. In the century since the Federal Reserve was created, the average annual rate of inflation has been 3.5%. Even using the official numbers, the value of U.S. dollar has declined by more than 95% since the Federal Reserve was created 100 years ago. Now, mind you, this is important because the dollar does not have the value that we are led to believe. It's not an accident that permanent income tax was also introduced the same year when the Federal Reserve System was established. The whole idea was to transfer wealth from pockets to the federal government and from the federal government to the bankers. Within 20 years of the creation of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. economy was plunged into the Great Depression. Now, if you can believe it, there have been 10 different economic recessions since 1950, and the Federal Reserve created the dot-com bubble. The Federal Reserve created the housing subprime bubble, and now it has created the largest bond bubble in the history of the planet. According to an official government report, the Federal Reserve made $16 trillion in secret loans to the big banks at zero interest during the last fiscal crisis. Now, here are the list of some of the individuals from this 131-page report, and we can thank two people, Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas, for getting this information to us. This is what you're not told. We, the American people, can't borrow money easily. Small businesses is almost impossible. And if you're poor, you have nothing. Yet Citigroup received $2,513 billion. Morgan Stanley, $2,041 billion. Merrill Lynch, $1,949 billion. Bank of America, $1,344 billion. Barclays, $868 billion. Bear Stearns, $853 billion. Goldman Sachs, $814 billion. Royal Bank of Scotland, $541 billion. JP Morgan Chase, $391 billion. Deutsche Bank, $355 billion. UBS, $287 billion. Credit Suisse, $262 billion. Lehman Brothers, $183 billion. Bank of Scotland, $181 billion. BNP, $175 billion. Wells Fargo, $159 billion. Dexia, $159 billion. Wachovia, $142 billion. Dresdner Bank, $135 billion. And Societe Generale, $124 billion. And all of the borrowers, $2,639 billion. That's $16 trillion they received in secret with no good collateral to back it up. That's the corruption of the system. Remember what I said, they're all interconnected. And then they choose who's going to be Secretary of the Treasury. They choose who they want to be the head of the Federal Reserve. They are in charge of all the central banks that are owned by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve also paid those big banks $659.4 million in fees just to help administer those secret loans. You heard me correct. To give them the loans they needed, we actually paid them for their so-called administration help of over $500 million. The Federal Reserve has created approximately $2,175 billion out of thin air and injected into the financial system over the past 5 years. This has allowed the stock market to soar to unprecedented heights, but it's also caused our financial system to become extremely unstable. So when you hear the talking heads on television tell you how the economy is doing great, different companies are doing great, A, more often than not, those companies are doing great because they are squeezing out labor, they are downsizing on expenses, including cost of the labor, they are outsourcing jobs, and they're frequently keeping their profits overseas, $31 trillion. So that is not helping the average person. And as a result, we then allow them to go ahead and engage in quantitative easing to stimulate the economy. Our economy is never stimulated by quantitative easing because the Federal Reserve is actually paying the big banks not to lend $1.8 trillion in excess reserves that they've parked at the Fed. Quantitative easing overwhelmingly benefits those that own stocks and other financial investments. In other words, quantitative easing overwhelmingly favors the very wealthy only. And that is unfortunate. The Federal Reserve has argued vehemently in federal court that it's not an agency of the federal government and therefore not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. The Federal Reserve openly admits that the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks are organized much like private corporations, and the Federal Reserve system greatly favors the biggest banks. Back in 1970, the five largest U.S. banks held 17% of all U.S. banking assets. Today, the five largest banks hold 52% of all U.S. banking assets. The Federal Reserve is supposed to regulate the big banks, but it's done nothing to stop $441 trillion interest rate derivative bubble from inflating, which could absolutely devastate our entire financial system. The Federal Reserve was designed to be a perpetual debt machine. The bankers that designed it intended it to trap the U.S. government in a perpetual debt spiral from which it could never possibly escape. And since the Federal Reserve was established, the U.S. national debt has gotten more than 5,000 times larger. The U.S. government will spend more than $400 billion just on interest on the national debt. Yet if we abolished the Federal Reserve and allowed the Treasury, that was mandated by Constitution, to print money, we would have zero interest on that. The average rate of interest on U.S. government debt rises to just 6%, and we may be paying out more than $1 trillion a year in interest on the national debt to these regional banks. According to Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Congress is the one that's supposed to have the authority to, quote, coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard weights and measures. So exactly, why is the Federal Reserve doing this? And finally, there are plenty of possible alternative financial systems, but at this point, all 187 nations that belong to the International Monetary Fund have a central bank. And that is not a coincidence. Now, earlier it was mentioned that invests in gold and silver. I also support that, but we also know that the big banks have been manipulating the price of silver and gold. And I believe if the truth were told, gold would go up to about at least $2,000 an ounce immediately. And once the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, it would probably go to $10,000 to $15,000 an ounce. Here's the latest from Max Kaiser from Global Research. Quote, we are on a gold standard now, even though it is not recognized. If you believe that gold no longer plays a role, think again. In effect, if you know what to look for, the world is on a gold standard now. In 1971, the U.S. closed the gold window, starting an era of global fiat money referencing pricing that has been unprecedented in history. Never has the world operated on the basis of no country having a currency tied to something with intrinsic value like gold. The petrodollar, a U.S. dollar exchange rate based upon the deal struck between Saudi Arabia and America for the U.S. to buy their oil, for the Saudis to buy U.S. dollars and bonds in return, started a period of oil companies with the military machinery in their pocket bullying the world into buying U.S. dollars or getting cut off from oil and dollar supplies, led to our current political situation with U.S. now involved in multiple wars in various oil-dependent economies and their satellites. And this lulled many into believing that gold no longer played a role. But current events proved these assumptions wrong. Leading up to the news that the Federal Reserve would not taper their bond buying, quantitative easing programs, meaning $89 billion every month in quantitative easing, the bonds are being purchased by the Federal Reserve. We saw a precipitous drop in the price of gold. Since I knew, like others, including Peter Schiff, Bill Fleckelstein, Michael Pinto, and even James Richards, who stated as much on Kaiser Report, that the Fed cannot taper at any point going forward without throwing the entire Ponzi scheme into the ditch and therefore causing every bank in the world to instantly collapse. It was interesting to see the price of gold trade down. Unless you know the Fed, working alongside bankers on Wall Street in the City of London, are actively managing the price of gold, along with stocks, bonds, and currencies. Knowing that the Fed, who is implicated in every recent major market rigging scandal in the world, in bonds and currencies, they're all tied in. Knowing this, then you have to understand that they would cause a panic if they told you the truth about how worthless the dollar is, and hence people would buy gold. And the people buy gold, it becomes even a quicker way for the demise of currency. It had to go into the market and drive the price of gold down ahead of the announcement, or risk seeing gold pop to a new all-time high of $2,000 an ounce or more. I commented a few weeks ago that to understand the Fed, you have to understand that it, along with J.P. Morgan and other too-big-to-fail banks, are one giant hedge fund. And this is a huge negative for the supporters of free markets who believe prices should be determined by the market, not the Federal Reserve. Surprisingly, a few days later, Warren Buffett made the same observation. He said, quote, the Fed is the most successful hedge fund in history. For Warren, this is true. He's on the receiving end of the biggest transfer of wealth in the history from workers and savers to borrowers and speculators. But for those not on the Fed's list of recipients of hundreds of billions worth of interest-free loans that never had to be paid back, the fact that the Fed is a giant hedge fund is devastating. It's no coincidence that the day after the no tapering of food stamps for bankers, a.k.a. quantitative easing, was announced, the government announced that the food stamps for the non-recipients of the Fed's free money were told that they can expect a taper in the form of cutbacks of their food stamps. The huge price drop in gold before the taper announcement is a smoking gun, proof the Fed does exactly what Warren Buffett says they do, operate like an enormous hedge fund, making free loans to friends, manipulating markets with impunity, disrupting prices, and with high-powered algo trading and fraud. In effect, if you know what to look for in the world, then you'll know that gold is a standard now. The price of gold is telling you that the Fed's Ponzi is running at full tilt and that the ravages have been such a destructive mechanism at the heart of the economy are beginning to unravel. Because even with all that effort, the trend of the price of gold is still higher, and at some point the ability to keep it down will fail. And then, as Warren Buffett said, you can see who's not wearing a bathing suit when the tide goes out. End quote, Max Keiser. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.